Trigger warning. If talk about suicide, domestic violence, or threats of violence trigger you in a bad way, I suggest you not listen to this episode. Hi, welcome to Missing Pieces, MPE Life, and I'm your host, Don Anderson. This is Season 3, Episode 10, Dana's Crazy Ride. Dana found a bunch of new half-siblings. Many of them wound up in showbiz. One was a famous model, one was a Hollywood cameraman, on such shows as Cops, and she has one who's a filmmaker. And he also was in a band back in the 80s that had a recording contract. And there's this other one, a very famous female wrestler. We're definitely going to get that female wrestler in for an episode. You can bet on that. Yes, whatever her half-siblings turn out to be, boring isn't going to be one of them. I'd like to thank all of you who supported this podcast by purchasing the cool-ass Missing Pieces merch. Go to missingpieces.printify.me and get yours today. To get in touch with Don, email me at Don, N as in Nancy, P-E at iCloud.com or on Instagram at npe_life_podcast. Now, here's Dana.
My name's Dana. I was a screenwriter in Los Angeles for 22 years. I lived in LA for 25 years. I am currently pursuing a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling, and I've completed my first year.
Are you going to specialize in NPEs or anything?
I will specialize in NPEs. I've created an online course, which I haven't launched yet. But it is kind of a conglomeration of everything I've learned in the last 6 years of my healing journey through this process. Well, I was born in Jacksonville, Florida at the Naval Base when my dad was in the Navy. And when I was 6 months old, my parents moved up to Ohio. I grew up in Troy, Ohio. I had a sister who... I still have a sister who is a year and a half younger than me. We're very close. I had a great childhood. You know, it was a small town. My dad was a policeman. Everyone loved him. My mom and dad were together and happy. They were young parents, so it was kind of cool to have young parents. But they were strict. You know, my dad was authoritarian. He was very protective of his little girls. My mom really was a feminist and really empowered both my sister and I to kind of stand up. So there was a little bit of headbutting because my dad, you know, he really wanted to protect these little girls. And then my mom was raising us to be outspoken feminists. So there was a bit of a problem there. And any arguments they had was usually because of that. So when I was about 13, I picked up a camera. Was really good at photography almost immediately. And then when I was 15, I became a stringer for the Troy Daily News. And I was surprised at how talented I was at photography. I ended up getting a scholarship to Ohio University for my portfolio. So what I'm getting at is my parents were not artistic at all. I mean, that's all that mattered to me was art. And I grew up in this very gray, small, flat Midwestern town and what seemed like perpetually cloudy skies. And from kindergarten, I could just think about getting out. I came home from kindergarten and announced I was moving to New York City. My parents said, "You don't even know what New York City is." And they were confused at that until they had like the parent-teacher conference. And in my classroom, there was a poster of the skyline of New York City. And I must have seen that and been like, that's where it's going down. That's where I'm going to go. But I can just remember from as long as I can remember wanting to get out of that boring little narrow-minded town. Couldn't wait.
So Dana's whole childhood was in Troy until she went away to Ohio University in Athens.
And then I dropped out of college when I was a sophomore, moved to Chicago for 2 years, then moved to New York City for 2 years, and then went back, finished undergrad, went to graduate school, got a degree, got a master's degree in film, moved out to Los Angeles in 1995, sold my first screenplay in 2002, and then lived in Los Angeles until COVID hit, and then moved back to Jacksonville, where my parents had retired, because my mom was by now widowed and on her own. I didn't want her to, you know, go through COVID by herself. And ended up staying for a while and decided to get my master's degree to go back and become a therapist. And I'm already thinking about how I can move to Spain or Portugal after Jacksonville. So I'm a gypsy.
I love it in Portugal. And it used to be cheap.
Yeah, thanks to us Californians. It's not.
I know.
We it's ruined our fault. Everything.
We ruined Oregon.
We ruined everything.
Like in Austin.
I have this conversation with my other friends who are gypsies, you know, my friend who lives in London, because, you know, you have these different, not even cities, but neighborhoods that have their moment. And they're like the best place to live in the world. And for me, that was Venice Beach. I lived in Venice Beach from 1995 to like 2010. And I hit it right at the sweet spot before all like the tech bros moved in. And it was like when I first moved in, it was totally sketchy and there were still gangs there and it was kind of scary. But I, you know, they didn't bother me. I was just a broke artist. But then I really was there for the early aughts, which was like the high point, I think of it. And those were the salad days. It was just amazing to live there then. And then that kind of, the bloom was off the rose for that. And then I moved into the hills, the Hollywood Hills. And that's kind of, it's isolating in its own way. You get the great views, but, you know, there's no sense of community in the hills.
Yeah, the parking sucks.
And well, that's why Jeff never could find me, because he never came over, because there was no place to park. I would always meet him out. So the sucky parking saved my life, probably. I found out in 2010, I was going to this nutritionist, and she was very fancy. And I was spending a lot of money on it. And she had me on the Eat Right for Your Blood Type diet. And so she gave me a list of all these foods I wasn't supposed to eat and the specific exercises I was and wasn't supposed to do. And so I thought, I'm going to find out which one of my parents has the same blood type and we can do like a twofer, you know, because that way they can get all the information that I'm paying for. So I remember calling my parents, and this is in 2010, and saying, hey, you know, I'm going to this fancy nutritionist and they're giving me all this information. Which one of you is A positive? And my mom said, I'm O. And my dad said, I'm B. And then I laughed and I said, well, I must be adopted because one of you has to be the same blood type as me. That's how it works. And my mom quickly said, oh, Fred, you're A positive. You always forget. And my dad said, I don't keep track of that stuff, Darlene. That's your job. Hang on. Let me get a piece of paper and a pen. And so he writes down all these foods he's not supposed to eat. And I just forgot about it. Flash forward 2017. He's in the hospital. He had had a heart attack a couple of years before, and he'd been having a lot of health problems. At that time, he was in the hospital. He was having internal bleeding. They couldn't find the source of it. And so they had to give him a blood transfusion. I flew back because I saw him when I FaceTimed him, and he just looked awful. And I had a feeling he was going to die. And I called my sister immediately, and I said, get on a plane. I think dad's going to die. Right after we got there, they came in, and they were trying to give him, they had like a big tray of all these bags of blood, and all in the bags was this giant B. And I tried to stop them because I said, no, 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 no. My dad's not B. He's A positive like me. And I was really concerned because I thought they were going to kill him. And they were like, no, no, he's B. We tested him. And I wouldn't let them do it until they showed me on the computer. And they said, look, your dad's been in this hospital. He's been in this hospital so many times. We tested him before. And so finally I calmed down. I just let them do it because he needed the blood. And I didn't even think about that conversation from 7 years ago. And then later, they couldn't, you know, my dad just kept going downhill and they couldn't do anything for him except to keep him comfortable. And so we were all staying in the room with them that night, and all the commotion had died down, and we had kind of started to process the fact that he was now in palliative care and he was not coming out of the hospital. So it's about 2 a.m. and I'm laying there and I'm kind of looking at him, and he's in and out of consciousness now, and they just have him on morphine. And my eyes travel up to this stand, and on this stand is clipped an empty bag of bee blood. And I get this really weird sensation all over my skin, and the hair in the back of my neck stands up. And I remember that conversation from 2010. And I quickly Google the blood type chart. And I'm not believing what I'm seeing because, and I already know this, a B and an O can't make an A. And so I roll over and I give the phone to my mom, and she says, "What am I looking at?" And I say, "A B and an O can't make an A." And my mom's eyes fill with tears and her hands start shaking. And she says, "Can we talk about this some other time?" And I said, "Yeah, we don't have to talk about it." But at that moment, I realized the man in that bed was not my biological father. And I was 51 years old, and I immediately started to like disassociate. Like I felt somebody had slipped me a Mickey or some, like a hit of acid or something. Everything became like this weird slow motion. It was late and I hadn't slept in 2 days anyway, but oh, and did I mention that Hurricane Irma is about to hit outside? We had one eye on the TV and one eye on my dad because they were evacuating neighborhoods all around the hospital. And my mom had already threatened to handcuff herself to the bed if they tried to evacuate her, because she was not going to leave my dad. So I waited until my mom kind of laid down and was asleep. And my sister was already asleep in like a lazy boy. My mom and I were together on a pull-out couch in the room with my dad in the hospital. And then I slid out of bed. I just felt like I was in a dream state, and that my head was going to come off my body. And so I went to the nurse's station and I said, can you show me where there's a bathroom where I can have a nervous breakdown? Because I think I'm going to start screaming. And she knew that my dad was dying. So I closed the door and I immediately look into the mirror. And I have this weird feeling like I'm in a movie. I don't even recognize my own face. And I'm like, whose face is that? And I feel that there's a scream, that I feel like I'm going to just lose it. And I never lose it. And all of a sudden I realize I can't lose it because my dad's about to die. I have to be present 100% for his death. I couldn't have a nervous breakdown. So I stared into my own eyes in that mirror and I said, just suck it in, bring it all back in. And so I did. I didn't even cry. And I walked out of the bathroom and I saw my mom down the hall. And I said, "Mom." And she turned around. And as she got closer to me, I could see that she was crying. The first thing I heard her say was, "We were just children. Please don't hate us. We were just children." And I said, "Mom, we don't have to have this conversation. We actually never have to have this conversation if you don't want to. We have to just be fully present for Dad right now." And then it's like she didn't hear me. She started telling me the whole story. And as she's talking to me, all of a sudden, I'm not in my body. I'm to my right, looking at myself and my mom in profile. This has never happened to me before. And as soon as I realized I was looking, I'm like, this is weird. Why am I over here? And then I was back in my body and I was facing my mom. And my mom was telling me what had happened and why and how Dad wasn't my biological father. And it was this other person.
And what did she tell you?
She said that they met when they were really young. They were 16 and 19, and they met on a blind date and fell crazy madly in love and dated. My dad was in the Navy. My mom was here in Jacksonville. And they got married in April, like after dating for about a year. And then by June, my dad was saying, "We're too young to be married. I think this was a mistake. I don't know. We don't know what we're doing." And my mom was like, "No, I want to be married to you." But by now she's 17. And then he got called away on a 3-month tour of the Mediterranean. And then he left and he didn't call her and he didn't write to her. And my mom was in cosmetology school at the time, and other girls were getting divorce papers in the mail from their sailor husbands. And my mom was just living in fear, just waiting for those papers.
It was during this time, when Dana's dad was off at sea, and her mom thinking her marriage was over, that Dana's mom got pregnant by another man.
And I said, well, who? And she started to cry harder, and she goes, I don't remember his name. I said, Mom, a guy put a baby in you, and you don't remember his name? And she said, well, it was really complicated. It didn't sound like it was spelled. I said, so you don't know who my biological father is? She was, no. He owned the cosmetology school I went to. And his first name, I remember his first name, it was Michelangelo. And she said, you know, I was really upset at school. And he just kind of told me that it was going to be okay and that I was beautiful. And, you know, don't worry about him. You'll have plenty more boyfriends and husbands in your future. And the next thing I knew, I was waking up in his beach house. And then she said it was only 6 weeks and I was pregnant. And he was like 18 or 19 years older than me. And I didn't want him to be the father of my child. So I just never went back to the school. I never told him. And then I spent the summer on my own. I didn't hear from your dad. He showed up in September and said, oh my God, I missed you so much. I absolutely want to spend the rest of my life with you. And my mom said, well, you won't want to spend the rest of your life with me. After I tell you what happened when you were gone, I slept with somebody else because I didn't think you were coming back to me. And I'm pregnant and I'm not going to give the baby up. And my dad said, well, do you love this man? And mom said, no, you idiot. I love you, but you left me. And she said, your father got down on his knees and he put his head on my stomach and his arms around my waist. And he said, I want to spend the rest of my life with you and this baby. You're my wife, and that baby is my baby. That's our baby. And we'll never talk about this again. And they didn't. They really never did until now we're in the hallway in 2017, and a hurricane's about to hit. And my mom's telling me this story, and I'm disassociating out of my body. And because I don't want it to be true at all, because my dad's dying. And, you know, I really love my dad. And I'm so much like my dad. And I couldn't get my head around it at all. How could this be true? My parents were still together. They'd been together since they were teenage sweethearts. They'd never broken up. There'd never been infidelity. We were boring people from Ohio. This is not what happens to boring people from Ohio. I didn't even cry. I said, let's just put all this aside and let's just be here for Daddy. And so we went back to the room and my mom went to sleep and I did not sleep, but I didn't want her to like know that I was upset. So I just kind of I was on my side away from her. And I just all night long, I stared at my father's face and I just memorized his face because I knew he wasn't going to be here very much longer. And then the next day, I got it in my head, because you do this weird thing, and Joan Didion wrote a whole book on it called Magical Thinking. You do this thing, and I did this thing where in my head, I remember asking my mom that day, I said, you know what, Mom? I think you're wrong. Did you and Dad have sex before he left on the 3-month tour? And she said, yes. And I said, well, how do you know I'm not his? And she said, well, I had my period. Now, I had been pregnant before, and even though I was pregnant, I bled and I thought I had my period, but it wasn't my period. It was implantation bleeding when the egg had implanted into the cervix. And so I told Mom, that wasn't your period. That was me. That was implantation bleeding. And so then I had this whole scenario in my head. And wasn't it going to be funny when I proved that they worried about it all these years? Now, mind you, I'd already put blood type out of my head because I wanted this to be true. So I concocted this story that I made my mom to prove it. I'm like, because my mom had to go home and take a shower. She hadn't left the hospital in 3 days. So she went home. I said, when you come back, stop and get a paternity test at CVS. And I'm gonna prove to you guys, like, that man in that bed, that's my dad. He's my biological father. I said, I'm just like him. There's no way it's not my dad. You know, she goes off and she calls and she's like, you know, I got the test. I'm on my way back to the hospital. And my dad starts to do the death rattle. And the palliative care had already prepared us for that. They said when a person dies, a lot of times they'll start to take very deep breaths. Their breathing will become very erratic. And that's how you know they're about to let go. So he starts to do that breathing. And my sister and I are freaking out because my mom's not there. So she's like, call mom. So I call mom and I said, Mom, hey. And my mom, of course, knows something up. She goes, what's wrong? What's happening? I said, oh, nothing. We just, you know, wondered, you know, if you were close. We're getting hungry. You want to have lunch? And she goes, no, I'm stuck across the bridge. There's something's happened on the bridge and I can't get over the bridge. And I said, oh, okay, well, you know, just whenever you get here, okay, bye. And I hung up and I look at my sister. I'm like, we're on our own. Mom's stuck. There's an accident on the bridge. So we realize, oh my God, we're going to have to like, this is it. Dad's dying and we've got to like do this. So I stood on his right side. My sister was on his left side and we just kind of held him. He finally took his last breath. And sometimes when a body dies, they start to release fluid out of their nose and everything. And so I turned around to get something to wipe it. And my sister gasped and she went, oh. And I turned back around. I said, what? And she goes, I just saw like a mist come out of his mouth and float up. And I was so pissed because I'm like, she got to see the soul leave and I didn't get to see it. And I was pissed about that. And so I was wiping him off and I said, Daddy's gone. And my sister, who doesn't know a thing, says, but his DNA will always live in us. We'll always have that. We'll always have his DNA. And thank God she wasn't looking at me. She was looking at my dad because I was gutted. And later when she did find out a couple weeks later and she realized what she had said, she was so upset. She cried. And I said, don't worry, you didn't know. And I said, but think back, why would you say that? That's so not a thing like you to say. And she said, because I could feel him slipping away. I could feel him leaving. And I wanted so desperately to hold on to something. Just hold on. I knew I had to let him go. And that's kind of what we were saying. We were telling him it was okay to let go and we would take care of mom and we were going to be fine. She goes, but I wanted to keep him. I just wanted to keep a part of him. And I said, yeah, I didn't have that. I lost him twice that day. I told the nurse, I said, when you see my mom, come and get us because we don't want it. I want to go out and prep her before she comes in. And also, like, when a person dies, sometimes you can't get their mouth to close. And so we were trying to, like, almost, like, dress my dad. We were trying to, like, fix him, prop him up so he didn't look so dead, I guess. And we were, like, doing all kinds of things. And finally, the nurse comes in. She's like, your mom's coming down the hall. So I run out, and she sees me all the way down the hall. She sees me, and she drops her shopping bags, and she just starts running. And she runs right by me, and she runs into the room. And then my sister came out, and we closed the door and let her have some time to be with him. So she talked to him, and then she came out, and she said, she hugged me, and she said, the paternity test is in the CVS bag. And so my mom pretended like she wanted to like go get something to drink at the cafeteria. And I took the paternity test because I really wanted to prove to them. And I opened it up and I swabbed my dead dad's cheek. And as I was doing it, it really felt like desecration of a corpse because he was dead. And I was talking to him the whole time saying, you know, you guys really are going to, I wish you were here because you're going to see that you were my dad. And this, all these years, you guys drove yourself crazy thinking it wasn't true. And I'm swabbing his cheek. I felt that it almost, have you ever seen that movie Sliding Doors with Gwyneth Paltrow? It was almost like in that moment, there was a hurricane and I got spun into a different fucking reality. Hurricane Irma hit Florida, like literally when my dad died. There was a major climate event. There was like a major, it was like the Wizard of Oz. we had to immediately go home and evacuate. We had to get the dogs. So we got the dogs, all the valuables, loaded everything up into my dad's F-150 and got on the highway, which was now bumper to bumper, evacuating Jacksonville. My sister didn't know. I couldn't tell her because she was in the back crying. My mom was beyond crying. She was just stunned that her husband had, she couldn't believe he was dead and was just, couldn't even talk. So she was in the passenger seat and I'm driving. The two dogs are in the back. My sister's in the back crying with the dogs. And I'm just sitting bumper to bumper traffic, just going, what happened? What just happened? How's this my life? It was very much like Wizard of Oz, or I'm now in this alternate reality that is not really happening. You know, I sent that away, and the next couple weeks through the wake and the celebration of life, I really thought the cherry on this shit sundae is going to be when it comes back and he's my dad and my mom's going to be so happy. But what happened was when I was flying back from Jacksonville to LA, and I had gotten the internet on the plane so I could start to write my dad's obituary, and I needed to like look up some dates and names and stuff. It had been a couple of weeks, and I got an email, and it was from the paternity lab. And I opened it up, and it has all these numbers and lines and columns, and I scrolled to the bottom, and there at the bottom it said percentage of possibility paternity, and it was a zero. And it just felt like another knife to the gut, because now it was really not like there was no denying it.
That must have been the longest flight to LA ever.
The funny thing is, I'm still friends with the woman who sat next to me, because we got on the plane and I could see she was really upset and she was already drinking. She was on the plane because her best friend had just died of breast cancer and she was drinking. And she told me about that. And I was like, wow, I'm so sorry. I have a friend who has cancer. I'm dealing with that as well. She was just like ordering wine, you know? And as soon as I got that email, we were probably like maybe an hour into the flight. I closed my laptop and I was trying to keep it all in. And I just started crying. And she said, are you okay? And I turned to her and I said, I told her, I said, just found out my dad's not my biological father. And she said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And I couldn't stop crying. And so she hit the button for the flight attendant, and the guy comes over and she goes, we're going to need the big bottle, the whole bottle of wine. And he brought us an entire bottle of red, and we just started drinking. And I don't even really drink. So I drank until I passed out. After that, I started telling everybody, anybody who would listen, because I needed it to be real, because it so wasn't real for me. And the more times I told it, the more it felt, okay, so this is my truth now. And then it just kept getting weirder and weirder and weirder.
Missing Pieces will be right back after a break. Hey, right quick, I want to make you aware of this cool-ass MPE course that Dana's created. Here she is. I'll let her tell you about it.
I created this course to help prevent the identity crisis and depression that usually accompany this DNA MPE revelation. I mean, I was knocked for a loop 6 years ago. I was completely untethered, and I know that's the way most of us feel when we get this shocking news. There are so many emotions, so many questions. It's overwhelming. So I created this guided course that goes through it with you. There are videos, guided meditations, exercises, and journal prompts, kind of unpacking it all and helping the healing process to begin.
Her site is navigationalnarratives.com. I'm not going to spell that whole thing out, but it's navigationalnarratives.com. And I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Check it out. Now, back to our story. So while her mom grieved for her newly dead husband, Dana decided on her own to look for her bio dad. And she turned to the best tool we have, Google.
So I just Googled Michelangelo Cosmetology School, Jacksonville, Florida, and his obituary came up. And it was this tiny little black and white picture of him. And I couldn't tell. I was like, is this him? I don't know. I can't really tell. So then I looked in the obituary for the children and I see four names. And so I get on Facebook and I find Mark and I look at him and I'm like, he doesn't look anything like me. And then I'm looking, then he has two daughters. So I'm like, oh, he has two daughters. Let's see what they look like. They don't really look anything like me, but I'm on the oldest daughter's page. And I see a picture that could literally be me at like 4 years old. And it's Mark's granddaughter. And it looks just like me. So I take that photo and I send it to my mom with no caption. And she texts me back and she goes, I don't remember taking this photo. Where was this? And I said, it's not me. I think it might be my grandniece. And she's like, oh my God, it looks just like you.
So Dana reached out to that guy on Facebook, and eventually they met for dinner, along with his daughter and granddaughter, the one who looked like Dana.
I was still very raw, because I think it was only 2 weeks after my dad's celebration of life, and sat across the table from him, and he was just, he had that great dad energy, and he like held my hand, and of course I cried when I told the story about my dad, and he said, as soon as you walked in, I knew you were a family. You look just like so many people in the family. And you look so much like our father. And he said, hey, you're not the first person. Every few years, a child pops up. My father was a prolific ladies' man. And he's like, there's also this person in Atlanta. And there's this other person and this other person. And we had a great first meeting. And he gave me a hug. And he's like, call me anytime. You're my sister. I got such a warm welcome from him. I started to reach out to the other ones and got a warm welcome from pretty much everybody I reached out to. But it was slow. It was slow because I didn't find. So then I did. So I found Mark. And then I said, oh, I want to do these other. Now I want to take the tests so I can see who else is out there. Because when Mark said, oh, yeah, he got around. He slept with everybody. I was like, oh, my God. At that point, I knew I had five. And I'm like, how many are there out there? So I took 23andMe, found one, took Ancestry, found two more. And then I think another one popped up. And so it was a total of 9 half brothers and sisters.
Wow. And how many of them grew up with him?
4 of them grew up with him, but not really because he married a woman named Fern. And he had the oldest girl, Margaret. He cheated on her with somebody else, didn't marry this woman, but had a baby named Victoria, went back to Fern because Fern didn't know he was cheating, had another baby with Fern. That was Angie. So now he has 2 children and then 1 out of wedlock. Eventually, Fern figures out this guy is sleeping around, divorces him. He's still in the girls' lives, you know, but like a weekend dad or whatever. He gets married again to a woman named Rose, has Mark. Very quickly, Rose realizes this guy's sleeping around. She divorces him. He gets married again to a woman, I'm not even sure what her name is. I want to say Peggy. And then he has a girl named Diane. Very quickly, she realizes he's sleeping around. She divorces him. At this point, he realizes 3 strikes, I'm out. I'm not getting married anymore. And now he just sleeps with women and knocks them up. So he put 10 babies in 9 different ladies.
Are any of the other siblings children of his students?
Yes. Melissa's mom was a student. My mom was a student. Terry's mom was a student. Trying to think. And that's all I know for sure. I think Jeff's mom probably was too.
If you want to be a player like that, that's the job to be in.
Oh, yeah. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. Like he started a cosmetology school.
Right. With a beach house.
Yes. I mean, talk about let me get the cutest girls in town. Right. And young. Like, none of the moms have anything bad to say about him, though. That's the weird thing. They're all like, he was so funny. He was so charming. He was positive. He was always like, you know, he was a nice person. He was very much not like the men of that era. He was an artist. He was a photographer. He was a painter. He was, you know, had been smoking pot since the 40s. He was into music. He was very much, my mom said, he was very much the artistic free spirit.
Tell me about when Jeff first came across your consciousness.
Jeff was one of the ones I found on Ancestry. And I saw that he lived in Chatsworth and I was living in Hollywood Hills. And I was like, oh my God, this guy lives like 25 minutes from me. So I emailed him through Ancestry and I said, hey, you know, we matched as half brother and sister. If you want to know about your paternal side of your family, give me a call. And so he called me up and he said, I was adopted. I don't know anything. I said, well, are you sitting down? And so I told him the whole story. And he's like, we have to meet up. So we met up the following week at Firefly in Studio City. And he brought his girlfriend of 10 years.
Jeff and Dana's relationship bloomed into one of those that some of us have, you know, where you feel like soulmates and just want to talk all the time. But then Dana started to see another side of him.
Now, Jeff and I were in utero at the same time. Jeff was born in July of 1965, and I was born in March of 1966. So basically, when Jeff was coming out, I was going in. So he just kept saying, like, he was estranged from his adopted brother and sister. And he just kept looking at me in this weird way at dinner saying, oh my God, I can't believe you're my sister. You're my sister. So we kind of hit it off. And then, so I met him in June. And then, you know, I would meet him and his girlfriend, Jerry, out. We went to concerts together. We would go have dinners. Now they never came over because I lived in the hills. And as you said, there is no parking in the Hollywood Hills. Forget it. And I only had a garage and there was no parking in front of my house. So I would just meet them, you know, down the hill. And it kind of became clear to me that he was a bit of a hot mess. And he told me, he said, listen, you're probably going to Google me. So I want to tell you before this pops up on Google. Last summer, I had an incident. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, the SWAT team had to come out. And he laughed. And I said, I laughed. I'm like, what? The SWAT team? And he said, well, I, you know, hadn't slept in a few days because, you know, I have insomnia. And Jerry and I weren't getting along. And I was really like going a little crazy. And I was kind of suicidal. And I pulled a gun out and kind of was threatening to kill myself. And Jerry was trying to intervene. And I shot a hole in the wall. And Jerry, of course, ran out and left and went to her friend's house. And then later she called the cops to do a wellness check. And they called me and I didn't pick up and I wasn't picking up. And then, you know, I finally went to sleep. I passed out and they kept calling and calling. And then I hear like a bullhorn outside. And so I pick up the phone and I was so mad that she had called the cops that I said, they wanted me to come out. And I said, if I come out, I'm coming out guns blazing. So there was a bit of a standoff and I finally came out and they arrested me. And it wasn't very nice. They like slammed me on the ground. I said, well, Jeff, you know, the SWAT team was out there. And he's like, yeah, I was in a hold and it was on the news.
And how early in the relationship did he tell you about that?
Oh, he's told me about a couple weeks into it. Cause he knew I'd probably find out. Mm. And then a couple weeks after that, his girlfriend called. Now he had already been having weird behavior and we knew that our biological father had died of Alzheimer's. And so we were at dinner one night and Jerry said, I wonder if Jeff, if you're having some cognitive, if your cognitive issues might be related to Alzheimer's. And just like, I don't know. And I said, cognitive issues? What do you mean? And she goes, well, sometimes we'll be eating dinner and food will fall out of his mouth. I said, what? And Jeff says, yeah, you know, I have problems sleeping. And then sometimes in the middle of the day, I'll just get really tired and I'll just like pass out, fall asleep. And he's like, and then I have really bad memory. And, you know, he's kind of describing all these things. And I'm thinking, oh my God, maybe this guy has like a brain tumor. And I said, you need to go get an MRI. So he didn't want to do it, finally did it. And then I remember Jerry, his girlfriend, calls me up and she goes, the results of the MRI was that he had brain shrinkage. Now, I had an alcoholic boyfriend who was in recovery, but had been a heavy drinker. And he had been sober for a couple of years when I had dated him. And he had brain shrinkage. So that's the only other time I heard the term brain shrinkage was in relation to this boyfriend.
I've never heard that term.
Yeah, brain shrinkage. It's connected to alcohol, to severe alcoholism. And Jerry confided in me that Jeff also had fatty liver disease, another ailment connected to alcoholism. So when she called me a few weeks later and said, I'm really worried about your brother, in the middle of the night, he got up and he went and peed in the office. I said, what do you mean he peed in the office? Well, he stood up. He thought the office was the bathroom and he pissed all over the office. Now, the only time I've ever heard of that happening is when in college, when guys would get drunk and go and piss in the closet or the corner because they thought it was the bathroom. And so everything started to add up. And I said, you know, the food flying out of the mouth, falling asleep in the middle of the day. I said, Jerry, you need to look for the bottle. And she said, what do you mean look for the bottle? I said, Jeff is drinking and he's got a bottle stash somewhere there. Look for the bottle. And again, I've had friends who were alcoholics, who were active alcoholics, and they hide bottles places. And so she said, Dana, I've never even seen Jeff drunk in my life. Like, he used to smoke pot, but I made him stop. And I said, he had his nose always had a bunch of busted capillaries on it. And so she's on the phone with me. And then I said, start to look. I said, look underneath the couch, look behind the couch. So she starts to look around and I hear somebody in the background and it's Marisol, her house cleaner. And she says, Miss Jerry, what are you doing? What are you looking for? Can I help you find something? And she said, I'm on the phone with Jeff's sister. She thinks Jeff's drinking secretly. And she told me to look for there's a bottle maybe hidden around here. And she goes, oh, I thought you knew. She goes, what do you mean you thought I knew? She goes, Mr. Jeff drinks all the time. Like, he has a bottle. He drinks in the kitchen and he has a bottle behind his desk. And she goes, what? And they look behind his like desk, and there between the desk and the wall is a shoe bag with a bottle of vodka in it. And Jerry immediately starts crying. She's like, Dana, I can't believe this. But she's like, now I'm starting to think his behavior's gotten worse and worse. I just can't believe this. I feel like I'm, you know, I feel so stupid. And I'm like, you're not stupid. You've been living with it for 10 years. That they're alcoholics are really sneaky. So she finally confronted him. He denied it. She showed him the bag. He blamed her and he said, well, you know, you made me stop smoking pot. So they got in a big fight and then she called me and I said, he's been drinking for a long time. It's not since you made him stop smoking pot, because you don't get fatty liver disease and brain shrinkage from just drinking for 3 years. He's been drinking for a long time.
So Jeff's drinking got even worse. Jerry stuck by him, begging him to get help. But then he crashed one of their very expensive drones because he'd been drinking on the job. So Jerry had had enough, and she gave him an ultimatum.
She said, I will let you stay at the house. I'm going to move into one of the guest bedrooms. You've got to go to rehab. That was her condition to let him stay. Because otherwise she was like, I want you out of my house. But he didn't have any place to go because he also didn't have any friends. He had alienated all of his friends over the years. So I drove him to rehab. I drove him to rehab. I sat through intake with him because he was too afraid to go in by himself. And then he didn't go. He didn't go to rehab. And then he...
Wait, because what do you mean? Did he leave with you or he stayed?
No, he left and said he was going to go back and get his stuff. And he just went back to Jerry's house and started drinking. And then he said to Jerry, "You can't kick me out because this place is on my driver's license. I'm staying." And she called me and she's like, "I don't know what to do." So she had me come over and two of her other friends to tell him he had to leave. And I said, "Before I come over, before you tell him to leave, you need to contact a locksmith and have a locksmith on standby, because as soon as he leaves, you're going to change the locks." So I came over in the morning. Sure enough, he was passed out in the guest room. It was myself, one of her female friends, and one of her male friends. And Jeff came out and he looked at us. He's like, "Oh, what is this, an intervention?" And Jerry said, "No, I'm going to ask you to leave my house." And he started laughing. He's like, "You're not going to ask me to do anything." And that's when I said, "Jeff, you're on probation. She's going to pick up that phone and call the police and you're going to go to jail." Now, this wasn't true, but, or it could have been true. I don't know. So then he got really mad, but he also acquiesced. He's like, "Fine, fuck you, and fuck you, and fuck you, and especially fuck you, sister." And he went and he got a bag and he left. And then he started calling, saying he was going to kill himself.
Calling her or calling you?
Calling all of us. Because she didn't, Jerry didn't pick up, then he called me. I didn't pick up, then the text started to come. And I said, "Just ignore him. We need to get the locksmith out here. And then you need to go and stay with your friend." So she left the house. I think that night or the next night, Jeff came and busted the windows of her house. And that began the odyssey of Jeff kind of like harassing and stalking Jerry, and also harassing and stalking me. And luckily he didn't have my address, so he couldn't really physically find me, but just countless phone messages and emails and texts. And I'd block him from a number, and then he would use like Google, like, you know, there's an app you can use that comes up on a different number. I just stopped answering my phone altogether. So he was living in hotels, and Jerry finally got a restraining order against him, and she put me on it as well. She had the process server serve him, and how she did that was he wanted some of his things. She packed all the stuff up from the house, but he had been living there for 10 years, so there was a lot of stuff. So I think he wanted like some of his vape canisters or whatever. So she put them outside and told the process server what time he was coming to get them so the process server could serve him. This poor little woman shows up to serve Jeff, and he attacks her and tries to run her down with his truck. Now there's a warrant out for his arrest. But let's not forget that Jeff was a cameraman for the show Cops for years. So Jeff has a scanner in his truck, and he knows how to avoid the police. And so he does that for 3 months while he just calls us and emails us and texts us nonstop.
So what kind of stuff would he email you or text you?
You know, I ruined his life. He wished he never would have met me. And they would say all these horrible things. And then the next one I would get, and this probably was when he would be drunk, "You're the best thing that ever happened to me. I felt complete when I met you. Why won't you give me a chance? I'm not a bad person. I just, you know, have some problems. Obviously, I've got some mental problems." And then a few times I did try to engage with him. And I said, "Jeff, I will absolutely support you and be there for you. I took you to rehab, for God's sake." I said, "But unless you are in active rehab, getting help for your alcoholism, I can't be in your life. I can't do it." I said, "This disease you will die, Jeff. This will kill you." And then he'd be like, "Fuck you." And then he'd call back up and he'd say, "Okay, I went to a meeting. You know, it was awful. He was really manipulative. And then when he got violent, I wouldn't see him because I was afraid. I was afraid of him, as was Jerry, because you never knew which Jeff you were going to get. And I started to realize that, you know, there was something. He had a mental problem. It just wasn't alcoholism. One time he came to her house and she called the cops. And by the time the cops got there, he had run off. And then he called her. He FaceTimed her. And he's like, I can't believe you called the cops on me. So she put him on speaker and she was talking to him. And she goes, well, I'm afraid of you because you've been acting so erratically. He's like, yeah, well, I'm not even that far away. And she's like, well, where are you? And he said, I'm at the, I don't know, like a Red Roof Inn or something, like a Motel 6, whatever. She goes, oh, just down on blah, 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 just down on some street. And he's like, yeah. And the cops heard that and they're like, we're going to go get him. Keep him on the phone. So, like, I don't know why they use their sirens, but so she stays on FaceTime with him, keeping him talking. And then all of a sudden he hears a siren or something. He looks out the window and he's like, you called the cops on me? You told them where I was? You know, fuck you. I'm going to kill myself. So then he hangs up. And then the next thing Jerry hears, about an hour and a half later, the cops call her. Jeff had barricaded himself in the room, tried to hang himself. He already had a noose made, apparently, because he was showing it to her on the FaceTime. So the cops went to the office, got the card key to get in the room, tried it, opened the door, but he had the metal thing on, so they couldn't get all the way in. So then they had to go back down and get a battering ram. By the time they battered the door down, Jeff had hung himself. He was unconscious. They had to give him CPR. He was unconscious for, I think, 3 days in the hospital and was obviously on a suicide hold. So he came to, but he's having a lot of withdrawal from alcohol. He's having all the symptoms. And they said, we're going to send you to a rehab facility. We're looking for a bed for you in a rehab place right now. He's like, I'm not going to rehab. So they discharged him and he called me and wanted to come stay with me. And I was like, no, you're not, you know, I texted him back and I said, no, you're not staying with me because you won't go get help for your alcoholism. And he's like, I'm desperate. I'm going to be homeless. I'm going to be living in my car. And I was like, I don't know what to tell you. You go go to the bed that the hospital has you in. He's like, I'm not going to inpatient rehab. And so he went back to stalking Jerry. And, then he sent her the email about, I'm going to blow up your house and I'm going to kill the attorney. Cause he had been for the vandalism and the, attacking the process server, he had to go to court. And I guess the city attorney pissed him off by whatever he said, but he got released on his own accord until there was going to be a trial date. And then he disappeared again. So once he sent the email that I forwarded you.
This is where I want to restate the fact that if you're triggered by suicide or acts and threats of violence, please stop listening now. This is the email that Jeff wrote to Jerry. And Jerry's given me her blessing to read it. All I ever did was try and love you, perhaps in my own fucked up, off-kilter way. But you are a goddess to me. My love for you will never die. Yes, I fucked up, but I will never stop loving you. You're my soulmate. Just know I'd never hurt you as I love you until the day I die, which will be sooner than later. I don't care if you report me to the police. If they fuck with me, they will be in for a surprise. I may not be able to own firearms in LA, but it turns out in Arizona, I can buy all kinds of fun stuff like claymores and Simtex, and they don't care. I'm coming home and will knock on your door with your stupid ring doorbell. As I drive through your front entryway, keep clear of the door, I'll stand my ground on the doorstep and wait for them. I'm not afraid to die by their hands. And if that's the case, so be it. I'll be taking some of them with me. I have 5 pounds of Simtex and 4 claymores ready at the wait. Sorry if it ruins your property value, but you drove me to this. I want to die by their hands, not mine. You've taken me to the lowest point of my life, and I have nothing to live for and no fear of dying. I'll be there in 2 days. Let the games begin. I'm too much of a coward to just off myself. Looks like we're going to be a Dateline NBC episode. I'd have it no other way. I plead you to talk me out of this, but I know you won't. Tell that pile of shit city attorney he's a fucking moron, and if I live, I'll be coming for him, due to his stupid smirk he showed me in court. I love you, always and forever. See you in hell.
She had been trying, because he had been stalking her and showing up, and she'd call the cops, and the cops weren't doing anything. And she couldn't even stay at her own house anymore. And she was really at her wit's end. This had been going on for like 5 months now. So once that email got sent, she did it. She sent it to the attorney. She called the cops. I guess the attorney went to the judge. They got a bench warrant to triangulate his phone. They found him in Texas. And they were trying to extradite him back to LA, and he fought extradition. And they finally got him back there. I think it took him 3 months. So he was back in LA County Jail. He had, wasn't a hearing, but like a preliminary thing where they bring you in front of the judge. They offered him 5 years in the state pen for like a plea deal. He said he would think about it. And then he went back to his cell and he hung himself. And this time he succeeded.
How long from the time that he committed suicide and the time you first contacted him, how long between those two times?
He contacted me in June of 20. Actually, I contacted him first in June of 2018. He was dead in April of 2019.
Oh, so not even a year.
Not even a year.
Wow.
And it was really upsetting for me. Because I did have like this weird guilt and I was really upset about it. And questioning myself. But Jerry, his ex, told me I wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for you. You know, because she said I'd been with him for so long and I loved him so much. She goes, you know, when I met him, everything was great. He was still working as a cameraman and, you know, his alcoholism obviously hadn't gotten to him yet. She goes, but in the 10 years we were together, she goes, I felt like a frog in a pot of boiling water. And he just kept turning up the temperature a little bit. Because she goes, when I found that bottle, I was just like, who is this? Who have I been living with? And then all of a sudden, it's like the scales fell from my eyes and I could see that this man, I went back in time and I thought about when I first met him versus now. And he wasn't even the Jeff that I met. I didn't know who this person was. And he tried to kill me. That he pointed a gun at me when the day the SWAT team came. I think he probably would have eventually killed me had you not gotten me out of it. And she loved him very much. And she said, I will stand by. If you go to rehab, I will come visit you. Every day they let me, I'll stand by you. I'll be here when you get out. I love you. I just want you to get better. I told him the same thing. I will come every day that you have visitation rights. And if they don't have visitation, I'll call you every day. Like, he had two people in his life that were willing to go through that with him. And he just would not do it. 5 years later, Jerry and I are still very close. We feel that the sibling I was supposed, she's the only child. She's never had a sister and always wanted one. And so she feels that I'm her sister, that I was supposed to find her and not Jeff. She's like, I think you and I were supposed to find each other.
I'd like to thank Dana for sharing her story with us today. And don't worry, she'll be back. If you haven't subscribed to this podcast, please do so now. That way you won't miss the next episode of Missing Pieces. Don't forget to check out Dana's course at navigationalnarratives.com. And it'll be in the show notes. I'd like to thank Billy Sullivan for supplying some of the music on today's episode.
He's a composer and has a full library of music. His website is sullystone.com. I'm Don Anderson, and I'm your host. And I can't wait to see you on the next episode of Missing Pieces in PE Life.